Hello and welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selina Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pevitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
Hi there, it's Selina here today bringing you this week's podcast. And this one is a bit of a different one. It's a bit of an experiment in a way and unique to the guest who I had on the podcast for this episode, who is the wonderful Alyssa Rochelle from Vulnerable Podcast. If you haven't listened to her podcast, go and check it out on iTunes, subscribe. She is, for me, one of the people to watch this year and over the next few years. I really can see her taking us to some really beautiful and deep and important places through her podcast. And I can see that podcast just rapidly growing in popularity, which in part is why I wanted to get her onto the Project Love podcast to talk to us about the Vulnerable podcast and why she began it. And I first heard her in her episode with Lucy Sheridan talking about white supremacy and white privilege. And I loved her openness, her candidness, the way she was raw and real and really spoke from a depth and a connectedness that basically had me hooked and wanting more. Also, of course, I mean, over at Project Love, we are obsessed with the whole topic of vulnerability. So the fact that someone has actually taken that topic and created an entire podcast around vulnerability, I think is just so powerful and so exciting, actually. And I think there's no better person to do it than Rochelle. So I reached out to her after I'd heard the podcast and I just said, I would love to have you on our podcast. So we met up and we chatted and she shared a little bit about her personal story. And I kind of had an inkling that there was quite a big story under there and that she was very much on her own personal healing journey. And so we kind of arrived at the idea that she'd tell her story, her whole story, her life story, for the first time on the Project Love podcast, embracing and demonstrating vulnerability in action. And it takes real courage because her story isn't an easy story. And for a long time, she swore that she would never share it and that she would take it to her deathbed. And she talks about that in the podcast. So it is quite a long podcast, but I didn't want to cut it down. I wanted Rochelle to really be able to tell her story uncut, because the most courageous thing any of us can do is share from the heart and just say it as it is. So thank you for joining us to create the space for Rochelle's story to be heard. And thank you, Rochelle, for having the courage and love to share it. So here you go. I have been waiting for such a long time and looking so forward to doing this podcast. Today, I am with the amazing Alyssa Rochelle,
hey,
who I shall be calling Rochelle.
Yeah, from now on.
From the Vulnerable podcast. And the first time I heard an episode with Rochelle was when you did an episode with Lucy Sheridan about white supremacy and white privilege. And it was such a powerful conversation. And I just felt like the way you carried the conversation, the way you took it immediately, just going into deep inquiry and really creating a sense of connection. Mm-hmm. I was immediately hooked. I was like, I want more from this woman. Aww. She's good. And also, and I really mean this, I don't know where it is you're going to go, but you're going places. And that really excites me.
I hope so.
You are. I know you are. Listen, I'm a good talent spotter. And I just thought, so anyway, I started to listen to more of your episodes and just the whole fact that it's the Vulnerable podcast. So that in itself, like, vulnerability is such a big part of what Project Love is all about. And it's, you know, anyone who's watched the Brené Brown Power of Vulnerability TED Talk.
Yeah.
It just really drives home the importance of us being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we have to if we want to have real human connection. Mm. And so I feel with your podcast, that's something that you do with your guests and you do for your listeners. And I've listened to their podcast about hypermasculinity, depression, motherhood, all sorts of conversations. And so I wanted to talk to you today about the Vulnerable Podcast and why you started it, why you wanted to do it. But also, I wanted to hear your story because you weave little bits and pieces into your podcast, into your episodes. And I just thought I would love to create a platform, create a space for you to tell your story whichever way you would like to.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much. Like, you do what you do, and I don't do it for, like, I don't know, I don't do it for like the accolades type thing. I want to have these types of conversations. So I've been thinking recently about like the amount of engagement we get on the podcast, and we do have people like yourself and Lucy that are consistently commenting. But I phoned my sister the other day. So you mentioned the depression and motherhood episode, and that's something that my sister has been through. And I called her and I just said, did you listen to the episode? And she was like, yeah. And I shared it with my friends and we cried and da 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 da. And I was like,
wow.
So people are being impacted and they're connecting with it, and I'm not necessarily hearing it all the time. So just to hear that from yourself, it's amazing and humbling, and it makes me want to cry.
I hear stories from your guests who it's experiences I've never been through, but there's something that just, I'm so grateful for it, because I get so connected to another human being, another human experience. Doesn't matter that I haven't had it.
Your capacity for empathy grows because you hear their story and you're like, okay, I understand a little bit more.
That's what you're doing. This is what I mean. No, this is why your podcast is so important and so powerful. Think of your podcast as helping people cultivate that their capacity for empathy, and how much we need that right now in our world. What drove you to start the Vulnerable Podcast?
So you mentioned Brené Brown's Power of Vulnerability TED Talk. I saw that years ago when it first came out. And I remember just being frozen at my desk, watching her talk and being like, oh my God, like everything that's coming out of her mouth. I think I was on the verge of tears. And I have to say, Vulnerability Podcast is really essentially for me to step into my vulnerabilities, because I've always been an emotionally closed person, and we'll get into why. So this was one of the first times when I couldn't stop the tears. I just couldn't stop them. As I was listening to her, and then I just listened to everything else. Her talks about shame and guilt, and I was like, this woman is like a fairy. What the hell? And it blew my mind that she could study it on an academic level. That she was combining like her love for emotion and connection and storytelling and academia at the same time. Because I felt like, as a person who is always connected for whatever reason, I'm always under, like, I always want to understand where people have come from or coming from. I feel like the spaces that I go into, especially with workspaces, I'm that person, and people are like, Rochelle, like, you don't do that, you don't need to connect to that person. They're not saying that explicitly, but it's kind of the way how society moves is in disconnection, and you're made to feel like you're less intelligent if you want to live in that space. And I actually mean like academic intelligence, like, why aren't you concerned with like atoms and the way how a soundboard works or whatever else? Like, why are you concerned with the way how people emote? Like, because I don't know, I just naturally was, I don't know why. But anyways, because she was able to connect the academia and that, I was more drawn to that because I knew it could be quantified as an official thing. Which is weird. It's kind of problematic in itself in a way, because it's kind of like, why do you need that validation in order to kind of be seen as a thought leader or whatever else? But anyway, so yeah, so Vulnerability Podcast was started by my infatuation with Brené Brown. And then what happened after that was, I just noticed that because of my type of personality, and I have this thing, I think people always have their thing, and my thing is that people tell me everything. So I'm that person that can get on a train and have the woman next to me talk about how she's just got divorced from her husband and da da da. I've literally had people like break down on public transport to me, like on a journey to and from Birmingham to London. Literally, like, I'm like, what the hell is going on? And my job requires me to get to those places with people. So my job as a pastoral lead in a school is about young people telling me their stories so I can then implement support for them. My friends do. And so I don't know, like, you know, the people say like you're a healer type thing. I think naturally I was just that person. So I'm hearing all of this conversation over and over and over again from different people that look nothing alike, that have completely different backgrounds, and they're saying the same thing. And my thing is, we're all saying the same thing. Can we talk to each other? And obviously that is really hard to do because it's an event, or I don't know, like, how do you get people in the same space? It's like the podcast is the easiest way. And I'm really grateful to Lucy for coming on the podcast to she introduced me to a complete new demographic that I would never naturally have been able to access. And that has helped the conversation further connect, if that makes sense. So yeah, that's basically it. It was just a case of, I was having all these independent conversations on my journeys and day-to-day life, and I wanted to create a space where I could have them on a platform where anybody could listen.
You could then share it.
Yeah.
So what is it that you would say then, that you keep hearing people of all different backgrounds, all different kinds of people, saying over and over again the experience? Is it that experience of disconnect? What is it that you keep hearing people talking to you about?
I think it's worthiness. I think a lot of people, doesn't matter where they're coming from. So say, for example, is it a divorce? Is it the fact that you cannot conceive a child? Is it the fact that you're a young person that I work with and you have a body image issue? Like, what is it? It all stems from lack of worthiness and people feeling like they're not enough.
Yeah.
So that was one. That was like an immediate connection, which is why I focused on episodes like self-doubt and had people talk about, like, not only the reasons for their self-doubt and how that how it was cultivated in them via their parents' self-doubt and their friends' self-doubt and all of this around them. They then got to talk a little bit about how they changed their mindset and saw themselves as worthy enough to kind of be like, yeah, worthy of abundance and stuff like that. So I think that the main underlying for me has always been worthiness, and I consistently hear it, and I battle with worthiness myself a lot. And I think on the connection thing, I think for me, hearing it all of the time makes me feel less crazy.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
That how many people are experiencing that? So it's that whole thing. And again, Brené Brown also talks about this. It's like, oh my God, it's not just me.
It's not just me.
Didn't she write a book called Not Just Me?
Yeah,
she did, yeah. Oh, Brené. She's just amazing. The other question I was going to ask then, with Lucy introducing to a whole different demographic, who is that demographic then?
It was white women, essentially.
Yeah.
White women who reached out to me, but women from Australia, just women from like places I have never been to, or like mothers and like older women, and just women that were just like, we really want to have this conversation, but we just don't know how to. And I was like, what do they want with this little black girl? Seriously. That's truthfully, that's what came out of my mouth. I phoned my friend, I was like, oh my God, do they know that I'm some little black girl? Like, seriously. But that's problematic in itself. But and it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
So they're still interested.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily talking about race in every single episode. So that is the demographic. And that did teach me something. That taught me worthiness again in a different way, because you know, systemic racism and the way how society is set up kind of like innately makes, I suppose, black women believe that their voice isn't worthy. And there are so many times, even at work, when there are time after time after time when I've said something and I've brought something up and it's been ignored or it's been fobbed off. And then a white man said it, and it's like, oh, we need to deal with this issue. And I'm like, I said that last year. Recently, I've actually just, an issue was brought up by email, and I just forwarded everyone the email that I sent last year saying the same. Because I was like, I don't care if this is petty, but like, people need to see that I actually raised this.
But I remember this in the world of work, which I was in. I was in the world of employment for about a year and a half. And I remember that experience with men and me being a woman, and another woman, my female boss, saying, this is how we need to do it. We give them the idea,
to the men also, yeah, that were like, you know, direct to the company. We give them the idea, and in about a month or 2 months, they will come up with the idea as if it was theirs, and yeah, then it will go ahead.
Yeah.
And that is what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so horrified that we were just, you know,
allowing it to happen.
This is the system, and this is how you have to work it. And I was just like, goodbye.
Yeah.
I'm not willing to be in that system. So I just completely checked out. But what I loved about your podcast with Lucy is that before, I suppose, I had felt like when it came to racism and, you know, white privilege, it was just like, my whole thing is like, but what can I do?
Mm.
And then after your podcast, it was like, okay, what can I do?
Yeah.
It was far more like, there are things that I can do. And a big part of it was realizing you need to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Or really, all you need to do. And I think maybe you even said that in the podcast.
Just listen. And don't like over explain that my experience isn't, because it's like the way how we all view the world and the way how we experience the world is completely different. Do you know what I mean? And so my experiences as a black woman from childhood, from a little black girl to the 31-year-old black woman that I am now, has been consistently, your voice isn't worthy, you were not worthy, da 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 da. And so like, well, once again, when I say, when this demographic of older white women from all over the world started to connect with me, it was I don't want to say validation, because it's not validation, it's more of a case of like, maybe what I was thinking isn't necessarily true. Maybe people do want to listen, and maybe the people that do want to listen are people that are ready to listen.
Mm.
Maybe it's like, maybe my truth is only true in this space. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So like, in a space where, at work, or in spaces where people are not necessarily quote unquote woke, then it's like, it's a problem, but it's not an issue every single place that I go into.
Yeah.
And maybe this is my purpose. That was the second thing. Maybe this is my purpose. Maybe this is the way that I am heard. Maybe this is the way that other people are heard.
Maybe this is the moment that
mm-hmm.
we begin
mm-hmm.
your personal story.
Mm-hmm.
You feel ready for it?
I do. I have a quote from
yeah.
guess who?
Come on, Brené.
Brené Brown. So yeah, so we've been trying to do this for a while, and I wouldn't say like, timing is everything, isn't it? It's one of those things where timing is literally the key to everything. And as I was thinking the past week, I was like, you know, what do I say? I was thinking like, I'm a Virgo, like, do I write down notes? Because I like to be over prepared for everything. I was like, Rochelle, you don't need to write down notes. This is what it is. We met before.
Yeah.
I spoke to you. I was like, I love this girl's energy. It's amazing. And then feelings of like shame started coming up, because there's so much that I've been through that I've held on to for so long that we'll get into. And then I started reading The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown. And there was this quote in the book that says, shame needs three things to grow out of control in our lives: secrecy, silence, and judgment. When something shaming happens and we keep it locked up, it festers and it grows. It consumes us. We need to share our experience. Shame happens between people and it heals between people. If we can find someone who has earned the right to hear our story, we need to tell it. So you've earned the right.
I really am so honoured.
Seriously. I couldn't think of any, like, of another space to have this conversation. So.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah. What was the question? I'm joking.
Where should we begin?
So my story. I'm originally from Birmingham. Born in 1986, hold tight, the 80s babies. The people that try and claim the 80s, I was born like 4 years, like, I don't remember it. I remember the 90s. And I was born in an area called Handsworth. I'm from an area called Handsworth, which is quite an inner city, kind of like deprived area. So just to kind of set the scene, it was very, very, very 90s, very Aaliyah, very Brandy, very like hip hop. Like, the one of my earliest memories was being in love with music. So in love, which is like why I kind of do what I'm doing. I do feel like music is a part of my thing, my core. And being irritated before the internet was even a thing that I had to wait so long for music to get to the UK. Like, I remember that. Like, I remember,
really?
Yeah. Like, I remember, like, knowing that certain tracks were, like happening in America. Like, my cousins would tell me about, oh, this song just came out or whatever. And I'm just like, oh, we have to literally wait for it. I'm just trying to set the scene of how, like, music was so influential in my life.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was that thing. So I was proper into music and dance and stuff like that. But I remember I have a at this stage now, I have a very kind of like fractured relationship with my mom, and I'm just trying to think about like the like examples of when those things started to happen. I remember like being so into music and literally feeling like it was in my blood, like that kid on X Factor that's just like, it's in my blood, like I was that kid, and saying to her, can I go to dance classes? And she was like, no. And I said, why? She goes, because you won't stay, you won't like it, you won't stay. And I was like, how does she know? Like, I remember having that thing, like, how do you know? But then once again, your voice isn't being heard. Mm-hmm. That was one of the first things. It's like, well, maybe she knows me more than I know me, because she's my mom. Maybe she knows my desires more than I know my desires, because she's older. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's loads of little things like that that used to happen consistently. My dad wasn't there when I was growing up. So, oh, there's so many places I could start. And so I apologize in advance if this is all higgledy-piggledy, because as the memories are coming into my head, I'm just trying to piece, literally put a picture together. So my mom is a devout Christian. She's always been. And when she got pregnant with me, she felt bad because she wasn't married. And I say devout Christian, I do think there's some mental health issues kind of like intertwined with her Christianity, because of the way how she dealt with it and because of the way how she continues to deal with things. So what happened was, she was in a church at the time, and the church were like, this is a sin. You can't be pregnant and not married. My dad was like, I'm not marrying you, because why? He doesn't need to. Like, I can raise my child. But she was like, no, God doesn't want you to be in my life if you're not going to marry me. And basically just kind of said to him, you need to leave. Like, just don't come around. You can't be around your child. And then, like, obviously, this is all stories that I've heard, because they've told me this now. I've heard her story and I've heard his story. And then he got a opportunity to go to New York and have a life. And he went, and he's been there ever since. So I never had him around. But what I did have was a mom who was very kind of spiteful and manipulative around that. I remember, like, there was a time where rollerblades came out and everyone was rollerblading. And I wanted to rollerblade. And I remember my mom saying, ask your dad. Why don't you ask your dad? Knowing that I didn't have access to the person, the dad. So it was just like, well, why was she so manipulative? Like, what? These little things. It's like, as a kid, you know it's wrong. You feel that that's wrong. That response is wrong. But at the same time, you have the cultural thing of, let me not say anything before she hits me. Let's not do that. And knowing that you just can't say anything, like, you just have to be quiet. And then, see, I think I learned over and over and over again that my voice wasn't worthy. So yeah, so that's just kind of like an, I'll give one more example. So this is all pre-10, like I'm pre-10, yeah? Mm. One more example. There used to be a trip that I used to go on every single year to Somerset, and I used to love it because my sister was too young to come with me. So I used to go by myself, and it was the best thing. We used to go to the law courts in Birmingham. The massive coach was there. All these kids used to get on the coach from all over Birmingham, and we used to drive to Somerset, and we used to spend, I think it was like a week of just living in this like countryside. It was amazing. And then the kids in the area and my sister became old enough to come, and that got on my nerves. And I remember sitting on the coach, and the girl that lived downstairs in my block was sitting in front of me, and she was crying because she was leaving her mom. She was literally like sobbing, bawling. She had a black bag so she could be like sick in it. The coach hasn't left yet. Like, we're still sitting outside the coach. And I remember being embarrassed because she was so upset, other kids were so upset, and I just wanted to go. And I remember like trying not to make eye contact with my mom, because I was like, if I look at her, I'm going to have to fake being sad, and I just can't do it. And I was angry because she was holding us up. And I'm like, as an adult, when I reflect on that, I'm like, that's not nice. As a kid, like, you want to miss your mom. But I'd never had that feeling where I wanted to miss her. So she established a very real disconnect from the very beginning. I think from when she decided that she shouldn't be having me, she disconnected from me in the womb, and that connection has never been established till today. So that's pretense. So we're doing all of that, and then it gets to the age of around 11. I'd say around year seven. I think it's year 7, 11, or was it like 12? I think around year seven, seventh grade. So, so she's still on her whole Christian journey. I do believe that my mum went through a phase of trying to repent for her sins, because I say she wasn't married with me, but she then got pregnant from my sister's dad and didn't marry him either. So she's just got this immense amount of judgment on her personal life and just hating herself, that I do feel like she tried to repent in so many different ways. So this man kind of like came to her via my sister's dad and just pay, I think, kind of like promised some kind of like salvation. Yeah. That's the word, salvation, of her soul. And as a result of that, like, it was very much so a cult. We basically ended up in a cult, basically. And I can't remember whether I've mentioned this to you already. No. So, okay. So, yeah. So because of this man and what he promised her spiritually, she was happy to once again sacrifice her children for this kind of like high five from God. I mean, I can't think of it in any other way. Basically, she wants to be accepted by God. And I think what she completely didn't realize is that she kind of, you are like, you're always accepted by the higher force. Like, you're always, you're not accepted by the people that are around you. But she wasn't, she was seeing them as their authority.
Yeah.
And not, so what happened with that is we were in this kind of very small cult for like my whole school life, so year 7 to year 11, and I was sexually abused consistently every day by this guy. And it was hard because it's done in the name of God. That's what makes it harder, because you then have to reconcile, like, why am I so upset every day? Why am I so tearful? Why am I in so much pain? And it's for God. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think as a kid, like, I was really angry. I was so angry with God. And I used to, like, I couldn't be angry at home because I would have got beaten or something in a different way. I was angry with other religious kids at school. So, like, it just sounds mean. And this girl, I've apologized to her since. She says that she thought I bullied her, and I didn't bully, well, in my mind I didn't, but basically she was a Jehovah's Witness, and so she was an easy target for me to kind of have conversations about God. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because they're a sect of Christianity, so they believe like different things, but it's the same thing, but it's different. It's just all strange. But because of that, I was like, I need to be able to have this conversation with someone who's in something that's different to Christianity, like I am, but not officially different because they have the same Bible. And I went back and forth with her. I remember, you probably don't remember this, but in around year 9, so I would say 2001, there was a documentary that came out on paedophilia in the Jehovah's Witness community on BBC Two. I remember it so clearly. And I watched it, like, there were basically just, you know, allegations of, like, kids being sexually abused in the Jehovah's Witness community. And I went to school the next day angry, ready to take down this girl and be like, what do you think about this documentary? Because I knew she would have watched it at home. And she was like, it's not true. And I was like, how do you know it's not true? And she said, because no, you can't be a Jehovah's Witness and be a paedophile. That's just not allowed. That was what she said. And then she said, also, if you do commit a sin, you have a group of like 11 elders who decide what punishment you should go through. So she said there's like a group of 11 elders who like will say, oh, this person's been, they've been caught drinking, because you're not allowed to drink or smoke or anything like that. This person's been caught drinking. What do we think should happen to this person, these 11 elders? And I clearly remember saying to her, but what if one of those 11 elders has sin? Then surely that whole conversation has some, asked me like how I was having these conversations in year 9. I don't know. Like,
already getting to the thick of it. Like, let's get to the heart of this.
Do you know
situation.
What I mean? But I think in that, I was trying to like understand what was happening in my own house.
Of course.
In a way.
Yeah.
So I was saying to her, but what happens if out of 11 people, like surely one of them has cheated on their wife, or one of them has done something wrong. So that whole conversation and that whole kind of like marker of truth is infiltrated, surely. And she was just like, but no, if you're an Audi, you can't be of sin, you can't have sin. And her shutdown made me even more angry. And so this is why I think she's like, she thinks I bullied her. Like when I saw her later on in life, I was just like, I'm so sorry. I was going through this thing. But like, yeah, that taught me that like, it was more confusing because I was like, people like elders and leaders of churches and community are seen to be without sin, and they hold a lot of sin, and I still yet hadn't identified what was happening to me as a sin. It was very normal. It happened for like 5 years. It was literally my life every day. Like I didn't see it as something that wasn't normal. So I didn't identify it as a sin. So that all happened, and God only knows how I got my GCSEs. God only knows how. And I mean, let me say this. So working in my current job, I have conversations with the kids all the time, and 2 weeks ago a kid came up to me and she was just like, I just want to let you know that I'm having therapy, just out of the blue. She's been trying to speak to me for a few days, and I managed to sit down with her. She was like, I'm having therapy and a lot's coming up for me, and I have no idea what to do with all of this emotion. Like I was like, well, okay. She's like, she goes, I've been speaking to my therapist and they've been identifying some things that my mom has done to me, that she's been doing to me, that has made me emotionally disconnected and I didn't even know. And I'm like, is this girl weird in my life? Like, how the, like, these are 16-year-old kids that are like, that are in touch with themselves so much. So I was like, well, what do you mean? She was just like, well, I don't think I've ever been taught how to feel. So I have no feelings. And I didn't realise that I didn't have any feelings until I started having therapy. And she literally only came to tell me that because she wanted me to tell staff, because she's like, I don't want to sit in a lesson and be completely disconnected and have them thinking I'm being rude, because I literally don't know what to do with all of these thoughts that are happening in my head. Wow. And I was like, that's what happened to me. But what had happened to me was I was so emotionally disconnected from anything that in that 5 years of secondary education, I didn't have any behavioural issues. I wasn't smelly. I didn't look unkept. I didn't look. There was nothing to indicate that I was a safeguarding issue, essentially. And it's because I was so emotionally disconnected on a day to day basis. Like there was just nothing there. There was no fighting. There was no nothing. Does that make sense? So I do think sometimes, like, how did that go unnoticed? Like, how did they not? How did all of the teaching staff and all of the safeguarding leads and nobody noticed what was going on?
Because we can be really good at putting on a mask.
Yeah. And I was really exceptionally amazing at it. Like knowing. And I think part of it was because I knew that it wasn't a sin. I didn't know it was a sin. So in my mind, it was just normal. But there are some things that I would have been like, how did that? But saying that, my best friend at school at the time had like a 25-year-old boyfriend when we were in year nine, who used to come and pick her up from school, and nobody clocks that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just like, but then I think I work in a school now, like, would I clock? Well, why would I not just think that person's a brother or something? There were so many safeguarding issues that happen in schools every day, and we obviously deal with what we can, but there's some things that you just don't know. And I don't know. I had to kind of then have a conversation with myself about not hating my old school for not picking up things, because do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in a place where I was ready to kind of have any type of conversation. So that ended at a point because my mom phoned the police after a bit. After 5 years, she phoned the police, and she has her own reasons as to why. I still don't understand it, because it was like she was definitely aware of what was going on. She phoned the police. I then got angry because I was like, I'm confused.
So just out of the blue, she called the police.
I got taken from a lesson. I think it was just like, you can't go home tonight, Michelle. And I don't remember asking why. I remember kind of just being like, okay. Like, I think I just knew. And when we got home, the police had taken all of the computers away, because obviously, like, paedophile, like, child porn and that. I don't know whether it was on the... I don't know what was on the computer, but they took all the computers away. And I don't know, my memory gets a bit weird after that, to be fair. I don't really remember what happened, but like, I remember having like a social worker, but like, I was just so angry. Like, all of my memory from like year 11, like during my exams and like until he went to prison, I just all higgledy-piggledy. I don't really have like a stream of like memory that's like in chronological order. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So he then went to prison and I went to college. so interesting as well. This is, I went to college and I wanted to work with kids. And I remember wanting to work with young children, like in primary schools. I mean, nursery, like being a nursery nurse. And because I had all of my GCSEs, I only failed my maths. I got all of them. I remember presenting my results on enrollment day and the lady saying, you should really not be doing a BTEC, you should do some A-levels. And I was just like, I don't know, like I've never, at that stage in my life, I literally would do what anyone told me to do. Mm. Like I was still in that phase of just being like, okay. Like I just don't know why I was always like, okay. Anyways, so I picked them on the day.
Wow.
I was just like, I'll do that, and that. Dance, media, sociology, and English literature. And
which actually sounds like a perfect combination.
Yeah, it was cool.
So you went from the gut, which is probably the best
thing. I liked dance. I liked English. I could do English. I was like, let me just do this. And media, I was just cool. I thought that's cool. And then sociology was the wild card, but that was the thing that changed my life. It changed my entire life. I would sit in lecture after lecture and be mind blown by the way how society was constructed, religion, cults killed me because I never knew that a cult was a cult until I went to college.
Of course.
I was like, what the do you remember like...
He was like, this is a thing. Okay, I was in a thing. I'm like, okay, now I understand.
100%. Are you aware of like the Waco incident?
Yeah, I've just been watching the documentary.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what he showed in the class. I swear everything. I was on the edge of my seat, shaking. Like, it wasn't that extreme, but it was the same type of mind control.
Of course, yeah.
The idea is that you follow somebody and that person is from God or they just know everything and then you kill yourself. And if that's what they tell you to do, you do that. And my thing is with either Jonestown or the Waco incident, when I've been watching documentaries, is the people that made it out alive that still believe today. And that blew my mind when they were interviewing people that still believe.
But isn't that the ultimate kind of disconnect that cults do so well, because they are able to disconnect people from their feelings? And when you were saying, I don't know how I could have been so just like malleable, just like, all right, I'll let someone else make decisions for me. If as a child you're being told, no, you're like this, no, you don't want that, no, this isn't how you feel, that's not what you want, no, that's wrong, that's right, not allowing you to express yourself and not encouraging you to listen to yourself and actually telling you that no, you're not being listened to and you're not worthy to be listened to, you're going to just shut that off.
So completely,
and then
gone.
How are you going to supposed to make decisions? Well, I don't have any compass to help me make decisions anymore because I've shut it off, I will find someone to tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And the charismatic cult leader who's going to be feeding with this stuff is like, wow, I want this person to tell me everything I should do. Or just anyone who happens to be there in a position of authority.
Yeah.
And it's that, basically. It's, you know, finding that. Well, we'll get into that part, finding that reconnection again.
Yeah. So sociology, as much as it was a wild card, whoever that lady was who enrolled me, God bless you. Aww. Seriously. She changed my life.
Aww,
she really did.
That.
So I then got my A-levels and then went on to study at university. Once again, still making poor decisions when it comes to choosing courses. I chose sociology because I liked it, and I chose media and culture studies because I thought it was a bit of media and a bit of culture.
Yeah.
I didn't actually read what it was. It's so bonkers to me, but I don't know how I managed to sign up for a degree that I didn't really research. Anyways.
Sounds like the kind of thing I would have done.
It's so random. So I remember sitting in my sociology lectures, loving it, and then going to media and culture. And it wasn't about culture in the way how I understand culture. It was about fine art. So we'd have to go to galleries and look at art.
Have thought it was about just culture. Just different cultures.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was crazy. But anyways, long story short, the summer of my first year at uni, I reconnected with my dad, and then he asked me to go to Jamaica to meet his family because I had never been around his family and spend time with him because I had never done that either. Got to Jamaica in July 2006 and fell ill in about a week with this thing called encephalitis, which is basically a viral infection to the brain. And so you have this kind of like infected fluid that travels up your spine, infects your brain, inflates your brain, and then eventually kills you. But it all happens in like a week, right?
Wow. And this was the first time you'd met your dad?
First time.
Okay.
First time.
And got an immediate life-threatening virus that could have killed you in a week.
That literally... So I remember being in Jamaica, obviously the food is amazing and stuff, and I love to eat, and I want to eat and I can't because I feel sick, like I feel nauseous the whole time, and that pissed me off. So I was don't take food away from me, like give me a headache, but I want to eat, do you know what I mean? And then this headache got so bad that I couldn't touch my face, like it would kill me to like put my head on a pillow. It was so painful. I didn't realize at the time that I had this thing. And then I remember getting up at night to go to the toilet and washing my hands and looking into the mirror on top of the sink, and then it just like disappearing in front of me, and I collapsed. And I had collapsed a few times before that in the day, but that was the last time when I collapsed, and everyone woke up in the house at night and they were like, you're going to the doctors in the morning, like we have no idea what's going on with you. And then when I got to the doctors, he was like, I think you have meningitis, so you need to go to the hospital. And I, with my emotionally disconnected self, said to him, so what, does that mean I'm going to die then? I was 19. So like, I was 19 and I was completely disconnected. And I genuinely, like, it was a real question. He looked at me and he was just like, are you stupid? You need to go, like, Jamaicans are very, very harsh with their eyes. Are you stupid? You need to go straight to the hospital. And I said to him, is it possible for me to get a flight and go to the hospital in England? And he was like, if you get on that plane, you will die. Go to the hospital now. And then within, like, I'd say 24 hours, I was in a coma. I was gone. But I have to tell you this part of this story. In the week that I was in Jamaica, while I was ill, I remember sitting on a beach and thinking about all of the trauma, the sexual trauma and everything that had happened to me, and making a pact with myself in front of the ocean and everything that I would never tell anyone, that I would bring it to my deathbed. Like, I remember that thought very clearly. And then within a week, I was on my deathbed.
Why did you make that pact?
Because I think that when I was sitting on the beach and I just could hear the ocean, like, you just go to a very spiritual space and it brings up things for you. So it was just coming up. I was just feeling really sad about everything. And then I was like, it's done now. It's not happening anymore. He's in prison. I don't need to talk about this.
So it was like drawing a line.
Yeah.
This is done. This is over. I can now bury it.
I can bury it. It's gone. You can have it. The ocean have it. I'm not dealing with this. I'm going to move on with my healthy life.
And your body went, mm-hmm.
And my body was like,
I've got another plan for you.
We're not doing that. If you say that you want to go to your deathbed, let's go.
Let's head there now.
Let's go now. We've got about a week.
That shit's crazy.
Crazy. That thought's crazy because I have a few memories of Jamaica. I remember going to this hotel and swimming in the pool. I remember going to get food and not wanting to eat because I was sick. And I remember sitting on the beach. Like, for that whole, I was there for a whole month. I remember that, and then all of my other memories are hospital memories. So I don't remember like the day in and the day out of what we did. So then in the coma, came out of the coma, and when I was in the coma, we're really getting deep. This is literally my entire life story.
I'm loving
it. When I was in the coma, I came out of the coma, and then my dad said to me that I told him everything. In the space where your brain shuts down in stages, from what I understand. So it's like you become unresponsive first. So I can talk to you and you can answer me, but you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
I have no memory of any conversation I had in
almost
that space.
Almost like being hypnotized.
Yeah, yeah,
you're
yeah,
kind
yeah.
Of under hypnosis, yeah. And you're talking and you wake up and you're like,
no, don't remember any of that. People, my friend who was there at the time, she told me about things that she would tell me. I don't remember anything. So in that space, when I was like secluded in this private room, because they still didn't know if I had some type of random tropical disease, I was just telling him everything about everything that had ever happened to me. I think it was like a confessional. We have still not to this day, he has not told me what I told him, but he had names of people. He had incidents. He was just told me everything. He just told me that I had told him stuff and he was angry. So I woke up and I was like, wow, like, did I really say all of that? It's so interesting to me that I had to be in that space to say stuff. Like, that's how serious it was. Like, I was prepared to hold on to it.
Yeah.
And so I had to go to a space where I was so unresponsive, like you say, hypnotized, to say anything. That blows my mind, even just saying it now.
It also blows my mind when you hold it up next to the pact that you made,
mm-hmm.
that I will keep this a secret to my deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're on your deathbed.
A week later.
And telling the whole story to your father who you've just met for the first time in your life.
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up.
You cannot. You just can't. So then he's angry because I think he's angry and he's guilty. He's guilty because he left me in the country with someone he thought could do better by me, my mum. And he's angry that he couldn't have done anything to stop it because he wasn't there. So he's just dealing with all of that stuff. And I can say that now as the person who hosts Vulnerable Podcasts who understands things. But when I was 19, I was just like, this man's just really, really angry. And like, not keep him away from me because he wasn't angry towards me, but I could see that he couldn't manage what was happening. I have to say, I also couldn't walk at this point because my legs just stopped working. So I was like in this bed, like not able to walk, not able to do anything, people feeding me, it's just all mad. And then I remember he said to me, so you're not going back to England because like what the fuck's going on in England? There's no one there for you, you can't go back there. You're gonna have to come back to New York with me. And I was like, I don't know you. I'm not coming. And I literally was like, I don't know you, like I'm not coming with you. And he was like, all right, well then you have to stay here in Jamaica with my mom. And I was like, no. We would not be doing that. I am sorry. And so the compromise was that I went back to Birmingham, but I stayed with my friend's mom instead of my mom was never going to take me in anyway. So I stayed with my friend's mom. And then literally, so that was the summer. So this is another powerful thing. I was in the hospital for about a month. So I came out of the coma and I had about two, three weeks. So my birthday is in September. So I've gone to Jamaica in July, spent the whole of August in hospital. And my birthday is the first week of September. So I'm like, I need to not be here for my birthday. I can't walk. I'm depressed. I'm developing anxiety. It's my first memory of an anxiety attack was in the hospital bed in Jamaica. And I just can't be here. And I said to the doctor, do you think I'll be out for my birthday? And he was like, when is it? And I told him it was like September the 8th. And he was just like, girl. He's like, do you know what you just went through? And I was like, yeah, but I do, but I just can't really be here. He was like, well, we'll just keep monitoring your bloods and we'll just see. And then I made another pact with myself that I would not be in that bed on my birthday. And he discharged me on September the 5th. Which is crazy. And I got the first flight, first thing smoking, as they say. And I was back in the UK on my birthday.
Wow.
So like, that was another thing for me when I was just like, if you can think it and you believe it, you can do anything. But also I thought that, but I didn't believe it. It was so weird. It's like these things were happening to me and I was connecting dots, but I was connecting them so briefly and then letting them go.
Yeah.
Because it's like I can't dwell on that. So yeah. I did get back to the UK for my birthday. So yeah, so that was 2006. And then I have never not been in education. Like I've only ever known study. So I took up like a level one counselling course. I would say, so I came back in around September, around January. I literally started in January. I started to walk again. I had my Zimmer frame and then I had my walking stick. And then I just remember like my legs were just not powerful enough to gather speed for ages. Like wow. I was just walking slowly everywhere because I just couldn't, I can barely run now to be fair, but like I just didn't have the muscle to kind of gather any type of speed. And I was on incapacity benefit at this stage because I just couldn't do anything. And so because of that, and then I moved out of my friend's house because I was just like, I just felt like a burden. There's so many things that come into like having all of the trauma that I've experienced in my life. Like having someone look after me is also traumatic in its own way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I discharged myself from my friend's house and I got a hostel. I moved into the YMCA, which is probably not the best idea. Around January of 2007. And I then enrolled on a level one counselling course. Once again, changed everything because it was like, it was about active listening. It was about, do you know what I mean? Like proper conversation.
Yeah.
And the teacher, I think her name was Sharon or something like that. She was hilarious. So I did that for like, I don't know what, 6 weeks, 7 weeks. It wasn't very long. And then I got to a point when I was like, I have to go to uni because I cannot live in the YMCA. I have no money. Where am I getting, like, what is my life? I have no support. And so I only went to uni to get a student loan, to get out of the YMCA. And I knew I could academically do it, yeah. But I was just like, I can't be here. So I enrolled on a youth work course in Leicester. It's all random. I could have gone to Birmingham. I could have just stayed in Birmingham, but I went to Leicester, but I commuted to Leicester. So anyway, so I got the student loan literally as soon as it dropped a deposit on a house in Birmingham. And I moved into that house and then started university. And that was great because the whole time I was doing, I was ill and going through all of these things, I was actually running a dance company. So...
Oh my god!
It sounds all crazy, but yeah, I was running this dance company.
Hang on, when did you start this dance company?
I started the dance company around 17, so like first year of college, and I started it with two other friends. The friend that I went to Jamaica with, whose mom's house I moved into,
right,
and another friend, and started it simply because I auditioned to get into a big dance company in Birmingham, and I didn't get in.
Yeah,
and so I was like, well, I'll just start my own. And this lady had some funding from Connections. Remember Connections?
Yeah.
To run a summer school, and she needed some dance teachers, and so she just gave me money. She was like, here, do this type thing. It was looking at the youth work now and what it should be like, it was awful the way how she set it up. She literally just gave us like £7 an hour, and we had these kids for 4 weeks from 10 till 4 every day. Crazy, ridiculous. It's completely bad. It's so bad. But I was just really excited because I was young, and we taught them dance routines, and then the end of it was that they were supposed to perform at carnival, and then we didn't want to let them go at the end, so we just formed a dance company.
Wow.
We're just like, okay, let's all be together then, because it was just us three to begin with, and then we had like all of these kids that we used to meet every single Saturday, and you know, make up dance routines and perform all over like the UK. it was a lot, but it taught me a lot about, so the whole podcast thing,
yeah,
and how I've managed it, like it's because I knew, like I had this social enterprise when I was 17 and we applied for funding, and it was, a lot was happening.
But that is amazing, because you know, you're telling the story of the things that happened to you, and then there's, and you know, how being told that you're getting that feeling, mm-hmm, that you're not being listened to, that, mm-hmm, you're not good enough, that you're not worthy to be listened to,
mm-hmm,
and then there's a side of you that's just like,
yeah,
you know what I'm gonna do, I'm just gonna start my own dance,
yeah,
company,
we're gonna
and
do
I'm
it
just
anyway.
Do this.
And I have to say, yeah, there's definitely a part of me that's like that, but it was carried and supported by these two girls who were so much more in my mind fierce than I was. It was almost like they were like,
what would they say to that? I bet they wouldn't say yeah, Rochelle's the sort of soft, shy one.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Probably not. I just felt like they were so much more powerful than me at the time.
But I think sometimes we don't realise how we are perceived in the world.
No.
At that time.
I'm that person. Kind of, yeah. I don't know, like everything that I've been through has led me to where I am. I don't know if you can see that. It's
yeah,
quite a clear thread of just like trauma, conversation, drive, like loads of different things, and it's like now I'm here. And so in 2013 I hated my job at this stage. I had graduated from uni. I was working as a mentor in a college in Birmingham, and they were horrible to me. It was horrible working there. Mm. My friend was like, let's go on holiday to America, and I was like, cool. And we decided we were going to go to the Essence Festival. And I don't know if you know about the Essence Festival, no, but it's this massive R&B festival that happens once a year in New Orleans.
Oh wow,
crazy. Like I don't know, like you, this sometimes I do things and it's like, oh my god, did I actually do that? So she was like, cool, I'm gonna speak to my travel agent, her family's travel agent. They booked it for us, and it's crazy. Like it's like if you're an artist, you're there. Like the year that we went, Beyonce performed, Brandy, Mary J. Blige, Jill Scott, Maxwell, LL Cool J, like these are all on the same stage. Like it's crazy. It's not, wow, like some like headliner and then everyone else. It's like,
and
no,
in New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like it was just crazy. So it was a whole weekend of performances at the Superdome, and then you get like you get life talks. It's the way how they do it, it's quite interesting. So they will have like the like lecture theatre style with like talks of people like Oprah. She'll come in and she'll just do a talk. Like everybody who's anyone is there. Oprah will do a talk at 2 o'clock on a Sunday. And then they'll have like anyone who's anyone in the church industry will be just delivering a sermon. And then you'll just have like radio shows happening. And we just went, like two young girls, like what the hell is this? Like we've never been around such like magnitude of like the entertainment industry, if that makes sense. Because it's like when things happen, like festivals here, it's like there's just the stage and that's the main act, and then you'll have like someone doing henna over here with some wink.
It's just not Oprah.
Yeah, it's not like you don't have to run away from Beyonce because you want to go see Oprah talk. Like that's mind-boggling. But anyway, so we did that, and then we went to New York. And on that journey, I was like, what am I going back to Birmingham for? Why do I need to go back? Because I have all of this debt. I have broken relationships. I hate everyone. The person who abused me is walking freely in the streets at this point. He's out of prison.
Right.
I've bumped into him a few times. Not like I've run away. Like, I don't know if he's seen me or if he's not seen me, but I've seen him. And then that makes me feel a bit sick. So many bad memories. And I just don't need to be there. And so I phoned my sister and I said, because she, you know, you give people your keys when you go away, just say, look after my house type thing. We were there for like 3 weeks. I phoned her and I said, can you please sell everything that I own? I'm coming back to Birmingham, but I'm literally going to hand my keys back to the landlord and I'm just going to go. And then I did. I literally came back and my flat was empty and I handed the keys back. And I went on this meditation retreat. Because my life is that random. So there's this thing called Brahma Kumaris. So I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have heard of that, yeah.
They have meditation retreats in Oxford and they have like centres around the whole world. And they do this thing every year for 18 to 35 year olds where you can just go and connect with yourself. And in like for free, they give you food, or the monks and that, they cook for you. It's just all really lovely. And I got rid of all my stuff. I had the biggest suitcase in the world. And sometimes when I see the people from the retreat, they remember my suitcase. But it was like a massive suitcase. And it was because I was moving from Birmingham, stopping off in Oxford to do this little meditation retreat, and then coming to London.
Wow.
So did that. That was a really good like stop off for me to kind of just connect. And then I got to London. And I've just been trying again since then. But to kind of establish myself, you know, working a job here that I didn't really like. And having people like, I want to say this because I do think it's important. I worked at a college in Bromley. And there was my manager started a rumour about me. And the rumour was really, 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 really stupid. It was very petty. And it was that I can't go back to Birmingham because I had some beef or something. Like, she just made it all up.
Just a silly joke. Yeah.
And it's just an example of how people really like that type of thing. And I remember thinking about it. She was like 65. Like, she was a grandma. She was one of those types of people that's always saying, oh, I'm leaving anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm leaving anyway type person. But she's been here for like 25 years. Like. And like when she started that rumour and someone came to me and was like, is everything okay in Birmingham? I'm like, yeah, why wouldn't it be? She's like, oh, because, you know, she says you can't go back. And I'm like, this is not the space that I want to live in. I don't want to live in a space where I'm entertained by that type of conversation or I start that type of conversation, because as non-invasive as you think it might be, or it's a small, tiny little lie, it says a lot about your character and a lot about the type of thing that you're willing to entertain, and the fact that you would rather start a rumour than actually connect with a person to actually find out the real reasons. Truth is, I would have never told her all of this anyway, but it was just like, you could have just asked me.
Yeah.
I never addressed it with her because there's no point. But I just remember thinking, right, I don't need to be in this space. And I think the biggest thing that has kept me safe and sane throughout the years is finding spaces that I feel safe in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I never felt safe ever.
Yeah.
And I look at my friends now and the people that I have around me, and I feel blessed every single day. And I do believe that I have been sent this, like, group of amazing people because I lack in so many other ways in terms of like family and stuff like that, but it's imperative to me to be around people who I'm able to connect with and be my raw self. It's like I can no longer hide that, because I hid it for so long it made me sick. And when I see people hiding it, I there's a concern, but then there's also the realization of they're not, like Rochelle, you had to go to your deathbed to deal with that stuff. They're going to need to go through whatever they're going to need to go through in order to kind of connect. So there's a space that I have to kind of like be open enough to hold space for them while they're not prepared to do the work. and hope that they do and they will get to that space and then be there afterwards kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then I make that choice for myself. So the choice that I make is the boundary, if that makes sense.
What do you mean?
When you're around someone who has potential in any kind of way, you see that potential and they don't, right? Mm-hmm. So it's that's how potential works, I suppose, when you see potential in someone and they don't see it, right? So it's like, okay, you have the potential to feel this way or to be able to connect to your emotions in this way, and you have all of that. I can see it and I know that you can't. But the boundary that I'm going to have for myself is knowing that even though I know that you can do that, I can invest in you by holding space for you, knowing that you may not ever get to that space. And so the boundary for myself is... the boundary or the managing my expectations is knowing that the people that I choose to be around me may not ever get to the space that I need them to be in for me. And that's crazy in itself, because it's like, what is that? They need to be in a space for themselves, but I know that our relationship will be 10 times better if they could get there for themselves, so we could be in an open and honest kind of like whole living space together. So the boundary is, or the, I suppose it's a boundary, and it's part boundary and it's part managing expectations, is knowing that that person may never get there. And I think that's just how I live. I genuinely think that's how I live with everyone. It doesn't matter how much I love them, there's parts of them that I know that will only ever get there when they need to. But the commitment is to love that person anyway. And that is the boundary for myself. So I think it's about knowing that you will do whatever work you need to do for yourself and holding space for other people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And it sounds like, it's interesting because now it kind of, what it sounds like you are, have always been very good at following, when it comes to following your heart, is going, this is not the place for me. This is where I need to be right now. Or this is not the place for me, I'm going to try here. So even after that whole, you know, you're in Jamaica and your dad's like, I want to protect you, come with me to New York. No. And considering you've let a woman who doesn't even know you tell you need to do A-levels, and you're like, all right. And then he's like, right, we'll stay here in Jamaica with your grandma. The fact that it sounds to me that in all of this, knowing where, finding those safe spaces and just, and that has been the key to you, considering all that the trauma that you've been through from such an early age, that's, there's got to be something that you've been doing that has been helping you to flourish onto the path you're on today, and you're still on that healing journey, right?
And still trying to work it out.
And that, but that's what's also great, is that you're turning up, you know, you're doing the Vulnerable Podcast and sharing these stories while still on your own healing journey, rather than waiting till, I think I'm done. I should share my story.
It's so like, crazy though, because you say that and I'm like, yeah, that's true. But at the same time with the gym, it's like I'm waiting for X, Y, and Z to be in place before I can go. It's just like, why does it apply to one part of my life and not the other? Type thing. It's just what really
needed. I think that's the way though. I think there are areas in our life where we're just like, we make good choices. Like with your career, you're just, you're, whereas there can be other areas, and this is how it was for me, relationship. I was making really good choices, really following my heart when it came, and really healthily when it came to my career. And then with my choices in relationship, it was just, just, I don't know where it was going, but it was definitely not going in a good direction for a long time. And then finally I was like, right, we need to recalibrate this area of my life. But I think it just sounds that you create... You seek out space that you can flourish in, but you also create that for others. It's like you're the queen of creating space, holding space, and within that space, allowing people to be exactly where they are without judgment.
Meet people where they're at.
Meeting
people where they're at. It's
but
so
that's
important.
What, and that's what I found, I know going back to, I mean, there's many episodes that I've loved, but that episode with Lucy about white supremacy and white privilege, it felt like we were able to be in there, people of all colours, being able to have that conversation because there was that space of allowance. It was like, this is where we're at. This is where we're at as a society. Rather than judge it, make it bad and wrong, and look to blame people, let's just talk about
let's
it.
Let's just talk about
something
it.
Something about well, it.
Like,
and
let's
it was
just,
like,
yeah, let's yes. just talk about it from a space of like not wanting to... Like you say, if I'm listening, let's just listen to each other. And I don't know if I said this to you before, but I never met Lucy before that. like I literally DM'd her. I was like, do you want to talk about this? And she was like, yeah. And then my thing was just like, I hope she doesn't come thinking that I'm going to ambush her.
Yeah. You said it in the episode, actually.
Did I?
Yeah, you said all of that in the episode.
It was such a big thing to me, like, yeah. Because I knew that's not what I was going to do. But yeah, she also said, well, if even if you did, like, you kind of would have had a right to. That's what she said.
Do you know what? Lisa's the kind of person that would have been up for that. She yeah. would have been like,
let's have this conversation.
So, like, because her role in that was to listen.
Yeah. Oh, right. So interesting. Yeah. And I'm there. I'm like looking at the sky right now because I'm just thinking to myself, like, there is no ending. It's a continuation of just like trying to work out how to hold more space for myself. Mm. And my newest thing, or what the thing that I've been dealing with mostly this year, is compassion for myself, because, like, I think I shared something on Instagram the other day about being 30 and not being married and all this. And that's never been, with all the things I've been through, marriage has been the last thing I've been thinking about. But I have got to a space where I'm like, if my life had been normal, if I had normal parents, if I had this, if I had that, I would have had a deposit for a house, I would have bought a house, I would have just been like more of an adult. And so the compassion for myself is your life was not set up in the same way as, like, I say everybody else is, but who is everybody else? Like, it just wasn't set up in that way for you to have those things. But look at what you do have. Mm. And be patient with yourself, because you're going to be wherever you need to be. Like, that's going to happen.
And also there's plenty of people who did have a healthy upbringing.
Yeah.
And are at that age and are like, what the hell am I got there either? Just like, because that's... And why do you need to?
Yeah.
I mean, that's for a whole different podcast.
It is completely different podcast. But yeah, that compassion of just kind of like being able to hold space for yourself, because you're saying, right, I can, you know, create safe spaces for other people and hold space for them. But like, I'm really trying at this stage in my life to really have that for myself. So a massive part of what I do is journal. Whenever there's a thought or a shift, like, I write it down. And that has helped me a lot.
Yeah, because also in that you... are being heard by yourself. Mm-hmm. You are giving yourself that space to be heard, mm-hmm. and to express yourself, mm-hmm. and to give that love and respect.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, when we become adults, however you want to interpret that, mm-hmm. as being, but when you become adults, it is about recognizing that you can now give yourself, mm-hmm. the things you didn't get as a child. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, reparenting your inner child.
Yeah. And becoming that inner parent, mm-hmm. as well as being the inner child, and being suddenly realizing you can be all of it.
Yeah.
And giving yourself the space to heal.
Yeah.
Because that takes the time that it needs to take.
And not, you don't need to put a time frame on it. Just let that happen.
No. Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. How does it feel?
I don't know. I feel a bit exposed.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just feel like, I just think it's time. Yeah. I really just think it's time for me to just be like, have it. It's not mine. Like, take it away from me. Like, I don't want to, the same way how I made that pact to keep it to myself, I'm making a pact to not now.
Yeah.
Like, it's like 12 years later. Like,
to own your story.
To own my story. Mm. Because it doesn't make me weird like I thought it did.
It makes you courageous, and it makes you inspiring and grateful that you, in sharing your story, and this goes for everyone, but particularly when you have a story, a traumatic story, mm-hmm. in sharing it, you create the space for others who've been through similar, different, but other kinds of trauma, mm-hmm. to also go, okay, to not have to have shame around it.
Yeah.
Because you're telling the story without the shame, without the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's by telling your story, it's a bit like with the goodbye hello journal. It's like you've told your story up until today. So now going forward.
There's more.
What's the next pact? What are you working towards now? Where would you love to see the Vulnerable Podcast or yourself going?
I'd love to the Vulnerable Podcast to what... again, create conversation for vulnerability, but in all communities, to be accessible to everybody. Like, everybody can benefit from being provided with the tools to have these types of conversations. So I'd love to see it as a platform, workshops, events, you know, talks, but like really trying to get into communities And I say communities, I feel like everybody could benefit from it. Like, I don't feel like it's a thing that's only beneficial for one type of person.
It's beneficial for everyone.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Literally, doesn't matter where you're from.
And I think that's what I hear with you, is you create a space that everyone is welcome.
Yeah.
And so keep doing it.
Thank you.
I'm excited to see where you go. And thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for having, like, literally, thank you for creating the space for me to share. Seriously.
We're space creators.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast show. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you're feeling stuck in your love life and finding dating to be frustrating and exhausting, then come and join Get Ready for Love, our 30-day online course to transform your love life.
As well as having us, Selena and Vicky, as your co-pilots throughout your journey, bringing you a lesson every day and videos and audio tutorials bursting with energy and love, you'll also be welcomed into our private Facebook group, The Love Zone, where you can hang out with like-minded women and ask for help and guidance whenever you need it.
It really is gorgeous in there. Head over to loveprojectlove.com/get-ready-for-love to sign up.
And if you'd like to find out more about love coaching with me, Vicky, then head to Coaching and Courses over on loveprojectlove.com.